This is the Senate Consumer and Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 315 at 3 o'clock p.m. on May 14th.
It's primarily a work session, but we've got a few...
Yeah, Bob Smith, if you want to.
Oh, he'll be up here in a minute.
Oh, there he is.
And Senator Burbidge should be on his way. He's just got out of another committee meeting. Senate Bill 259, we have somebody. Who's going to give us some amendments on that? You going to, Hank?
Senator Roberts, members of the committee, I'll take a very, very short time with this. I think you're aware of how long this bill has been around in your committee and how we as the industry have toiled to try to make it save what we had intended originally. You now have a bill of that type before you, and I think there are copies for each of you. I would only review with you...
Is this a substitute now, Hank?
Not really, because there are two new sections and a slight bit of new language in it. You can use it as a substitute bill if you would want to, but it's basically the same bill.
Okay.
You'll recall that you had voted the bill out of your committee, and we had asked to bring it back in because we weren't sure we'd really put the safeguards that we wanted in it and that we knew that you thought were in it. I draw your attention on the mimeographed copy that you have, the underlying section, which is new language. It basically incorporates the old language, but phrases it a little differently to be more clear. Where it says, nor shall defense or claim of usury apply to any other loan on which the maximum rate of interest is controlled by any Federal Reserve Bank of the United States or any department, bureau, board, commission, or agency of the United States, including any corporation wholly owned directly or indirectly by the United States. Now that's important language, but frankly the most important to you at this time, because those are areas we've discussed, is the new subsection 2 under section 1. This is what we've added to make it perfectly clear in the statutes that nobody could exceed these rates as guaranteed by the federal government in these various areas. And it says, in no case may the interest charged on a loan made under subsection 1 of this section exceed the total of the rate charged or otherwise established by the governmental agency or entity securing, insuring, or purchasing the loan, and the rate ordinarily charged for such loans for service, loan, or participation fees. That then, Senator Roberts, a member of the committee, would guarantee to us that the federal government does have the last say as to what the rates are, would allow the people I represent as the mortgage bankers, the other lending institutions who are wholeheartedly in support of this bill, to go ahead and adjust their interest and not be shackled by the usury statutes if the federal interest rates on these various loans begin to exceed our current usury statutes.
Questions?
What?
Senator Jernstein.
Well, just a comment. This is a whole new bill.
Yeah, it is.
Probably the most expedient way to handle it, yes.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Also, in Section 2 now, so that you're not misled, all we've done, Section 4 is really only a repeat of Section 2, except that it speaks to a different section of the law. But the language is the same. Again, the subsection has been added to make that guarantee. So I think it's not necessary to go over that word by word with you.
Chairman, I move we adopt the amendments.
Motion is to adopt the amendments to Senate Bill 259 and have the bill engrossed. And have the bill engrossed.
Bill engrossed.
Okay. See, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Clerk, call roll on the motion to adopt the. Is there any further discussion on the amendments? Clerk, call roll on the motion.
Senator Howard.
Aye.
Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstein?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. And Madam Chairman, is it possible to just send it to the floor without having it come back to committee? Again,
is there an objection? We'll have to take a vote, and there has to be 5 aye votes.
I'd like to pass it to the floor do fast.
I want to ask a question, Hank. Could you come back up for a minute? What's the maximum interest rate now on these guaranteed loans?
Well, it fluctuates, and actually sometimes fluctuates from month to month. Or possibly Vern knows exactly what it is at the moment. I'm not really aware. It's in the 9% area right now.
But if it fluctuates and it's based upon, then and if you went to the maximum, you're not saying you'll go to the maximum, you just can't go over the maximum.
That's right.
But you could go up to the maximum of that is in effect at any moment that you make the loan.
That's right. Let's take the example of right now. Let's say that it's 9 3/4, which it's not, I'm sure, at the moment. This statute would allow us, under the current statute, we'd be out of the FHA business, as an example, because we do have the 1% loan fee that is added. That's standard throughout the industry. It's not anything particular to Oregon or any particular bank. We would be out of the business. Under this law, our 1% fee would take us to 10 3/4. But because this was passed, we would then be able to continue in the FHA market in the state.
Senator Burbidge, we've adopted these amendments.
To what bill?
259.
259.
As unfortunate as it seems, the predictions of the industry are that those rates are going to approach that level rather soon in 75.
What's the maximum rate you can charge now?
10%.
10%. So if it went up, if it were at 9 3/4, you could charge 10 3/4.
We could not under the current statutes, but we could under this.
That's
yes.
What I'm saying.
See, there are certain things under our statutes which are required to be used in the determination of usury that are not specifically the interest rate being charged for the loan. You've got to add those loan fees in or a variety of other things.
Is the loan fee generally the same between institutions?
Yes.
I think it is generally on the FHA. It's conventionals, it can vary by half. That's not in this bill.
Conventionals would not be touched by this.
Okay, what all would be covered now under this? FHAs, VAs.
All right, the various federal programs, like, and I'm only familiar anymore with the slang of them, though, like the Fannie Mae's, the Jenny Mae's, and so forth. This does leave it open-ended enough to say, which we feel is coming, by the way, to be able to take advantage of any new federal housing program that was established. Just a few years ago, the only federal housing program we thought of was VA and FHA. Now we've got the Fannie Mae's, the Jenny Mae's, the other things that are continually thrown into the hopper to try to stimulate the market. If they were thrown in and had guaranteed interest rates, then it would be covered under the bill. If they did not, then it would not be covered under the bill.
Okay. Other questions? The motion is to pass Senate Bill 259 as amended and engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator
Howard?
Aye. Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Thursday? Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. I'd like to skip over Senate Bill 310. If you want to follow your agenda, we'll go right down, but I'd like to skip over 310 until we get down to one of the other landlord-tenant bills. 504.
I have that letter from Mr.
Okay. Do you have copies or just one?
I just have the one.
All right. All right. For the information of the committee members, you remember we had Mr. Patterson, the Seventh-day Adventist, objecting to this bill, as well as some people in the brokerage business, or in the futures interest business. Mr. Patterson has written a letter addressed to me in relation to Senate Bill 504, we should like to report that after research on the matter and further consultation, we are in support of Senate Bill 504, A engrossed as it reads, and as we understand the actual language of the bill. Especially Mr. Glenn E. Patterson. So the Seventh-day Adventists have withdrawn their objections to the bill. And
are you ready for...
I'm ready for a motion.
I would move that we send Senate Bill 504 before the Senate be passed. There's no amendments, is there?
Yeah.
Did you amend it?
What's the status of the bill, Jerry?
I believe it's already been engrossed and the amendments are in it.
A engrossed? Does that combine 504?
Oh, wait a minute.
6 with 504. A engrossed.
Oh, I see. A engrossed 504.
Right.
That's all.
Let's see. We changed the definition of security. Where is that? Where are the amendments, Jerry, that we made?
I'm getting them here.
This is security.
Well, it's
security on page 6. Bob, what's the one you're looking for?
Well, I was trying to figure out what amendments we adopted. We changed the definition of security. I know that.
Well, we did a lot. Mr. Healy combined 506 with 504, and he put it into one bill. And that's why we have all of it, and that's why we have an A in gross Senate bill, because he wanted to combine the two bills.
My opinion that Mr. Healy had satisfied everybody, hadn't he? Everybody that was opposed to it. They all seem to be together now.
Not those who are dealing in certain kinds of...
Oh, no, silver and gold, they wouldn't be.
No, futures.
Or future commodities.
Well, I think we took care of the future commodity question.
Yeah, I thought we had...
He tried to convince them that they did not come under the bill, but he didn't succeed in convincing them.
I think he has subsequently brought them around.
No, yes. Because I had a phone call just yesterday. But would you have any objection, Madam Chairman, to have legislative intent go into the record?
No.
Well, then why don't you word it? Because you are a lawyer, and then...
Well, you're
a lawyer anyway.
We get it out of Mr. Healy, that's for
who. Who did you hear from?
Well, that Bob...
Rosenthal.
And who is he? Which futures market is he involved?
Plywood.
And they're not executed or traded on any board, are they?
Yes, they are. They're on the Chicago Board of Exchange.
Well, if I was on the board, then he's not included.
I know, and that's the point.
That's what Mr. Healy was trying to make to them,
and they just...
Here he is right now.
Mr. Healy, you can just sit down.
right up to the table.
Right ahead over there at the table, Mr. Healy.
Well, now he buys... He also buys directly.
I'll bring you up to date. We just read the letter from Mr. Patterson, so that's taken care of.
Now, would that make any difference?
Now, the question is, have we satisfied the concerns of Mr. Rosenthal, who was here? Have you convinced him that you're not going to do terrible things to him under this bill?
I don't know that we've convinced him, Senator. No, I can't say
well,
that.
Well, Mr. Healy, let me ask you this question. This does not involve a future transaction that is executed or traded on any board of trade,
no.
Exchange, or market. However, if I am in the plywood business and I buy plywood and I store it in my basement and I make an exchange or a promise to sell a commodity at some future date, am I under this act?
Yes, you are. Well, if you sell this for, and not as a part of the trade or commerce, if you're in the business of manufacturing, if you open in your, and this is what it's aimed at, say in your house, and you started taking orders for plywood, and future delivery in September, and you ask from me for full payment, or substantially full payment on that order of plywood, and then you would be under this act, because that's exactly what's happened with the silver and the gold, that they've taken payment in advance and to be paid back with the commodity. And that's the point of this. Now, this has no effect on existing traditional methods of trading in futures, because those all come from or are carried on through the exchanges. It's the exchange that guarantees the contract.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. I know a little bit more about it. It's traditional in the livestock industry to contract for future delivery.
When?
Yes.
It's not a future.
That's part of the ordinary business, isn't it? You're not
yes.
outselling these for cattle futures for investment purposes. And that's the point. It's a term that we've used in the definition of a commodity investment contract, where it is sold for investment purposes. So we feel that we have distinguished it from the ordinary commerce, or the farmer selling his crop or mortgaging his crop. That
well, let me
of
ask you the plywood question in another way. If I were normally in the plywood business, I dealt on the future market, which does not come under this act, but I also bought and sold plywood in my normal course of business, some not involved in the futures market. Would I come under this act?
Would you be selling it, advertising it for investment purposes, or would you be, say, if you were in the furniture business or something where you wanted to secure your supply of wood, is that what?
Well, the point is, in the plywood business, as well as any future, there are speculators
yes.
who are buying the commodity. They do it in the normal course of business, but it's held for speculation, and the question is, how do you separate that point under this act? And that's
but they do that through a board, don't they?
Well, no, they don't, Mr. Healy. Many times they do it as a normal course of business in the commodity itself, be it plywood, livestock, or any other.
And do you pay in advance?
Yes. It's a down payment with a promise of delivery, which may be in the future.
With the balance of the payment
yes.
here. Yeah. Well, here, this is a present payment for future delivery, is what our language says. Bob, you...
Well, it still is.
We tried to, and you're not. The basic thing that we're after, what we've tried to describe here, is that where you're offering commodities, present payment for future delivery of commodities, for as an investment situation, then, and you're not doing that on the exchange, then that's the type of thing that we're aiming at, yes. This is the problem that we've had with the silver and the gold.
Yes, well, I don't deny that we ought to give you the authority and the opportunity to close in on a fraudulent speculator
yes.
and a commodity. My concern is that we're getting involved in in other areas, and it's a broader coverage than we intend, and I'm not sure how I can help you restrict it.
Well, now we have, so I say, circulated this. Rosenthal's primary argument, as I understand it, is that because of the federal legislation that regulating commodities, we are, by this act, creating a dual system. And that is not true, because the federal law will preempt the field and will totally regulate it. All we're looking at here is that aspect of the commodity business which the federals do not exert jurisdiction over, and similar to the experience that we've had. So I don't know that we can give you guarantees that we have done all that we could here.
Madam Chairman, if I might pursue this just a minute.
Sure.
What, this act merely allows you to investigate, to challenge, to take to court those individuals who...
Yes, it brings them under the securities law. Now, if these individuals want to sell the gold and silver as the way we have described it, then they can do that if they come in and register with our office and show financial capability and all.
Now, it's the Registration Act. Well, I don't know what to say, Madam Chairman. I really don't want to get in his way of this effort, but I'm worried about the definition of commodity investment contract, and I don't want everybody who in the normal course of business sells on a future market any commodity has to register under the Securities Act. That's my question, and I don't know what to say about it.
Madam Chairman, I think it's vital that someplace along the line that we stop these people that are advertising gold and silver or something, and they take, you send your money to them, and you never get a product. Someplace along the line,
exemptions, they accept all commissions.
And I think that this is what 504 and 506 put together are going to do. Bob, may I try something on for size here?
Try it.
We had an argument, quite an argument, in several bills this year. We just had one between the real estate commissioner and the home builders, and as to what the intent of the bill was. Now, last night, the home builders and AOI and the real estate commissioner got together and drafted an intent. And this morning, it was delivered to every member of state and federal affairs and made a record of the committee that, and in that bill, they was only trying to, they don't want to get all the home builders or all the subdividers in the state. There's three in the state that they want to get, and they just put a letter of intent. That's what they were after. Now, with that?
Well, sure, depending on the letter of intent. That's our whole problem. We can't define what we want to define.
Well, Madam Chairman, I wonder if I might make this suggestion in view. There are other aspects in this bill that are of substantial importance. The commodity portions here we think are of value. Now, we have instituted suit involving the silver and the gold traders on the theory that that promise to deliver gold or silver is an evidence of indebtedness. We feel some question as to whether or not the securities law applies to that. But I think that if there is substantial concern of the membership of the committee as to the scope, and I can't give them that, I don't have that degree of technical expertise in the commodities area, other than to say that we have circulated this as widely as we could, I would like to suggest to the committee then that we, you may want to consider deleting the part of the bill relating to the commodities, if we could get the rest of the bill. I don't think that the commodity is as vital or as important to us as other sections of the bill. I think that's what I'm trying to say, that this commodities thing clarifies our position, I think, but is not absolutely vital.
Madam Chairman.
Okay, Senator Smith.
I'd like to help Mr. Healy with this bill, and I don't want to hold it up unnecessarily, but I would like to take the language of subsection 3 and discuss it.
Section 3 or subsection 3?
On page 1, subsection 3.
Okay.
And discuss it with legislative counsel to see if my concerns are valid. If they aren't, then I just pass the bill. If they are, we can strip out commodity contract and go as Mr. Healy suggests.
Okay, will you take that responsibility?
Yes.
To do it, son? And we'll not wait for another work session when you're ready to say so.
All right.
And we'll put the bill on.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Healy.
Thank you.
If we ever get this bill going, it'll be a miracle. Senate Bill 599. The Employment Agency bill that was worked on by Senator Powell. We discussed it in the work session, and it has been amended, and there were some proposed amendments. We adopted some and rejected some from the Employment Agency person who was representing here, and I'd like to know the consensus of the committee.
Madam Chairman, I move to table Senate Bill 599.
Senator Powell has moved that we table Senate Bill 599. The clerk will call the roll.
Where is she? What's that clerk?
I'll call her.
How are you going?
She wants to call legislative counsel. I'm sorry.
Do you hear what we said back there? We're understaffed and overworked.
You're all right, Jay, but you just ain't pretty enough.
Okay, the motion was to table Senate Bill 599.
Okay, Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Jensen?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chairman, I move to indefinitely postpone Senate Bill 599.
Excuse me. I think it had 4 aye votes. That's the majority of those present.
Oh, wait a minute. Did I count wrong? I counted 3. I'm sorry.
4.
You may be right, John. Were there 4?
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's
right. Very
that's right. Wait a minute.
Majority of those present.
Same number of table is this.
Same number of table is it? No, not to pass. No.
Not to these rules.
Vote of the majority members present shall be required to table the measure. Bill 599 is tabled. Senate Bill
651. I got a
662, but I
understand.
Now, this is one that we just completed the hearings on. It's the first time it's been on for a work session. We had
to move the table up there.
Motion is to table Senate Bill
651.
651. I'm sorry, 651. Clerk, call roll.
Senator
Burbidge?
No. Senator
Howard?
Aye. Senator Powell?
Madam Chairman, is this the one that has to do with credit bureaus?
No. Fair credit reporting.
The one we just heard?
Oh, yeah. The credit reporting.
Yes.
I just had a phone. Here. Let me look at that until I find out.
did you make the motion to table, Senator? Stan Howard withdraws his motion for the Senate Bill 61. This is a bill that Mr. Hamilton from the ACLU supports, and then we had the opposition, Mike Dewey's people, who came in with the federal consumer credit reporting law, maintained that it was adequate. That's the summary of the testimony.
That's a good motion.
Is this your bill?
No.
All right. I renew my motion to table the bill.
Motion is to table Senate Bill 651. Clerk will call the roll again.
I know, and I'm ready to fight.
Senator Gervish?
What did you do now?
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No. But it's a table.
It's a work session, right?
It is a work session. Yes, it's a work
session. What is the status of that?
4-2, it's a table. Senate Bill 856. Gee, maybe we can adjourn tomorrow and I'll go home. Please put this up.
You promised to adjourn.
You always got that major in there.
Okay, we got some amendments on this one. This was the fisherman's bill, insurance bill, and they were going to work with Mr. Howard on some amendments. We've got some.
This is a whole new bill.
Sure is. Mr. Howard here? Is he coming back?
What this was, Madam Chairman, was you asked him to see if there was some way we could fit him under existing statutes without giving them an exemption.
Yeah.
And so this is the these are the amendments.
But did he check it out with the fishermen?
That I don't know.
They took off fishing, didn't they, to California?
Yes, I think they said they were leaving that day for California on their boats. So I doubt if he had a chance to check it out.
Okay. If the committee doesn't mind, then we'll leave this and let Jerry check it out with the fishermen.
Well, okay,
Is he getting his expenses paid?
Are you going to fly down there?
I'll go.
You're going to find out some way. We can't work on it just on the advice of Mr. Howard when it's their bill. Check with Senator Ripper. He's the one that's put it in. He's the one that ought to be bird dogging. Bill 860, the chair would ask for a motion to table at Senator Brown's request. She is going to work this bill into one that's in her Judiciary Committee that we're working on up there.
So moved.
Okay, motion is to table Senate Bill 860. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Burbidge? Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jersey?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 920. I'd like to know what the committee, if the committee wants to further consider Senate Bill 920.
Senator Burbidge, where's he?
Just left.
Is he coming back?
He left his cigarettes.
He can smoke in here today.
This was one that the insurance commission, real estate commission, was involved in, isn't it?
Real estate division supports it. FLCIO supports it. You have some amendments?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you tell us about them and give them to us and see?
Let me call you.
Did we amend the
bill?
Yeah.
It's
been
more
jippity
than that. I'm afraid of a table. You wouldn't take it off the table.
Of course I would. Of course I would, just ask.
I'm Walt Rich in the Real Estate Division. In the last hearing, there was an amendment offered by a representative of Consumer Credit Counseling Service. Since that time, we have talked with CCCS, and we have come up with the amendments that we have submitted to you. Number one, change the surety bond to a blanket position fidelity bond, naming the state of Oregon as additional beneficiary. Two is changing the ORS section 745 to read, every debt consolidating agency shall prepare a statement upon written request from the debtor or his representative within a reasonable time period. Such statement shall cover all transactions between agency and debtor. Number three, examination requirements required in this section do not apply to any nonprofit agency in business prior to 1 July 75. And number four, any debt consolidating agency organized as a nonprofit corporation under ORS Chapter 61 shall take their fee at a rate no greater than $10 set up and $10 a month. Now, they have agreed to this, and if we can submit this as amendments and part of Bill 920, I don't really find any opposition between the division and consumer credit.
Mr. Rinke was representing some of the interested parties in this. Have you talked with him about the amendments?
I just gave him a copy of the amendments, and he referred to Mr. Sweezy, who is here from CCCS, to talk about it, if you have any questions to answer.
Well, what was the answer?
They're in favor of it. I talked to Harry Strain this morning, and he's in favor of the amendments as we have here, putting them in with 920 and having the bill sale. This will allow them to live with it and allow the state to have the authority to go in and look at the agencies that are in trouble where we don't know.
So the amendments.
Okay, the amendments are not in proper form.
Well, that's because I prepared them.
But, pardon?
That's because I prepared our choice.
Well, they're not so that we can actually write them into the bill, but they are in certainly proper form for us to understand. The motion is to adopt the amendments. Jerry, you'll have to put these into the bill in the manner in which they all would go in normally as amended. Are there any objections to adoption of the amendments? Okay.
So we can get this thing on the road, if you look it over after the amendments are, could we just set it to the floor?
You want to make a motion to...
I'll make a motion that after the chairman and administrative assistant have put the amendments in, if it's okay to send it to the floor, do pass as amended.
Okay, we'll have it amended and engrossed, and then send it onto the floor after we've checked it out for accuracy in terms of the amendments. The discussion on that motion to do pass recommendation.
Sounds like state and federal affairs.
I just want you to know you're with the only chairman I'd do that for, Madam Chairman.
Well, I bet there's another one around somewhere.
I don't think so. Not one I serve under.
That puts a burden on me to check out the bill. Maybe we better have it engrossed and return to committee to look at it.
No. I want you to do it.
You want me to do it, huh? Okay, you've heard the motion. Clerk will call roll.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Jernstein? Aye. Madam Chairman? Aye. Jerry, do let me forget it.
Okay.
House Bill 2061. House Bill 2061 is the landlord tenant bill that we heard again just recently.
All room.
Okay. And there were some concerns for some relatively minor changes, or at least some amendments. Paul, do you have those? Who's done?
I do not have the amendments before, but for the bill, but I can read you the amendments and they would go in the bill. Those were prepared by Richard Forrester, and I have them written in a blank copy.
Are you just going to talk about this or anything else?
That was about it, unless you have more amendments that you wish to adopt.
Okay, why don't you sit down and run through it with us? Just the amendments.
So the amendments go to, the first amendments go to page 3 of the bill. Subsection 5 redefines the
the security deposit cannot be used to require, or cannot be required or forfeited to a landlord upon the failure of the tenant to maintain a tenancy for a specified term. That's supposed to get at these practices where a person will require a deposit that you say 6 months before you get your deposit back when your tenancy is actually a month-to-month tenancy.
Okay, as I recall, that was simply to state the language a little bit more clearly, just
yes.
for intent purposes is all. Okay, the next one?
I would suggest just an amendment to clear up the spelling on page 4, line 25, health is...
We've already noted that one, thank you, though.
Fine. And then in page 5, line 29, Senator Jernstedt, I believe, had a problem with the language here, and we put in the landlord, after submitting to the landlord, receipts or an agreed-upon itemized statement.
There is a mistake on our amendments, Madam Chairman. Paid should be scratched. Receipts aren't paid.
Say that again.
We have on page 5, line 29, after landlord, insert receipts paid or. Paid should not be in there.
Should say receipts or.
Receipts or, yes.
And then on page 6 of the bill, line 8, the notice provisions which apply generally to the grossly negligent or deliberate refusal of a landlord to supply an essential service would read, until he has given reasonable notice under the circumstances to the landlord.
Okay, that was Senator Cook's concern.
Yes.
Right.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Would you not want to also amend line 26 on page 5? Or does that take care of the notice, or does that take care of the...
How would you want to amend it?
Well, I think Senator Cook's point was, and I agreed with him, that the tenant may give written notice specifying the breach, but there wasn't time for the landlord to respond to correct the problem.
If I may respond to that, Madam Chairman. Subsection 5 applies to all the whole sections. It applies to the language in subsection 1 and subsection 3, so that it by making the change in subsection 5, you change it automatically in subsection 3. So that problem Senator Cook's taken care of.
Okay, it just relates
well,
back.
Well, now wait a minute. The amendment on page 6 has to do with notice. Is that correct?
Yeah, reasonable notice to the landlord.
To the landlord. Reasonable notice is different than reaction after notice.
Okay, well then what you would want to do is on in subsection 5, again, to add at the end of that, after until he has given reasonable notice to the under the circumstances to the landlord, you would want to add to enable the landlord to provide the essential service.
There you go.
And that would not change the intent of the bill at all.
That's the point that Senator Cook had, the point that I agree with.
Well, but there, the discussion was that there might be a time when the landlord couldn't act if he's out of town, gone
that,
for a period of time.
If I may, subsection 3 of the bill deals with that particular problem, especially paragraph B of subsection 3 says, notwithstanding the notice provisions, that in case of an emergency, written notice required by this subsection or attempted oral notice followed by written notice may be given as promptly as the conditions permit. So in terms of when a landlord's out of town and you cannot reach him to let him repair, you can give it as you must give notice that as promptly as the conditions permit. If it's a sewage run over and you have to fix it immediately, you can go ahead and do so. In my opinion, the addition to paragraph A of subsection 5 that I just read does not really change the intent of the bill. It may clarify it a bit, but it won't harm it in any fashion.
Steve and Richard, if we add Senator Smith's language and the language that Senator Cook was talking about when he was here before, do you agree that subsection B takes care of it? If it's going to satisfy Senator Smith to add that language in 5, is that what you want, Senator Smith?
Right.
Okay.
I have another question.
Okay, let's finish this one first.
Get that some funding, get this stuff.
Do you have that language, Paul? Until he's given reasonable notice.
Until he has given reasonable notice under the circumstances to the landlord to enable the landlord to provide the essential service.
Okay.
I can have these amendments.
We just add it to this.
Fine.
Okay, we will. Is there an objection to the addition of that language to these amendments? Okay, are there further questions of Paul? Senator Hahn.
Now, if I own a home or apartment and somebody's just tearing hell out of it, how long does it take me to get him out of there?
With the addition of subsection 3 of section 3 on page 4, it'll take you one day plus the time it takes you to go in and file your FED action if he doesn't leave.
Then could I lock him out?
No, you cannot lock him out. It's, in my opinion, it's unconstitutional to lock somebody out without a prior notice and hearing.
Security registration.
Other questions?
Move the amendments.
Motion is to move the amendments to House Bill 2061, and the chair would like to have it engrossed because it'll have to go back over to the House for concurrence. Are there any objections to any of these amendments? Okay.
Now, Madam Chairman, are there any other...
Steve or Mr. Hawes, Mr. Forrester?
We'll get all the amendments in here that...
Madam Chairman, these amendments are fine.
It may be for speculation.
All right, I thought we were getting them all worked out.
Right, they're fine with me.
Well, if it's a Senate bill, okay, you can explain it, but if it's a Senate bill, it could be taken care of in the House if it passes the floor.
The problem, I believe, is on page 8, section 11, subsection 3. Presently, and when you serve an FED summons, the hearing is 2 to 4 days prior to the date of trial. That provision was put in by the sheriffs who want a little more time for service, and it would read not less than 3, no more than 7 days. You could add it to this. I believe the Sheriff's Association desires that you do, but...
We're on the last floor, 2061. I'm kind of inclined to not. We don't have the time periods written in here, and it seems to me that we ought to be able to take care of the 700 bill over in the House.
Yes, we don't. Even
or do this in conference committee or something or other. Except that. Now let me think. No. The sheriffs want it. If this bill passes...
One of your problems is that you might just get concurrence without a conference.
Without, that's right. Well, where would you put it? Where do we do it?
In subsection 3, line 26, on page 8, it will be, the service shall be not less than 3 instead of 2, nor more than 7 days. Now, the Sheriff's Association, again, is the one who is sponsoring that particular measure.
What's the pleasure of the committee? It would remove conflict with the bill that will be on the floor, I guess, very soon.
So that's our judiciary bill, then?
Yeah. Be not less than 3, nor more than 7, right?
Correct.
Okay, the chair would move that we amend the bill on line 26, page 8, the 2 to 3 and the 4 to 7. This one? No.
Rena Grossman brought that.
Discussion on this motion to change the days. Well, do I hear any objections?
No.
Okay. Change it then. What was the vote in the House on 2061?
I believe it was...
How much?
50 to 5.
On 2061?
Is that all right?
I thought it was... 38. Yeah, I thought it was 38-20.
38-20.
I believe it was 38-20.
Well, but the amendments we've made are not really a substantive amendment. So okay, Chair, I'll entertain a motion to accept the bill.
Before we do, did we leave the small claims concept in the bill? That was not removed.
You mean the form?
Well, no,
that?
They prohibiting attorneys in the where there's no.
Oh, Section 12 and Section 13.
Yeah,
yes.
We left that in?
Yes.
Okay, I move it out.
The motion is to move House Bill 2061 as amended, which will be B engrossed, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Is everybody satisfied with this thing, though?
Sure. We'll find
Do
out.
Do I hear any objections from anybody sitting around out there?
Well, Madam Chairman, if I might, it's an issue that can be addressed on the other side of the legislature, but the amendments to 795 do add a time delay into an FED procedure.
Well, we talked about that up in Judiciary and decided that there was a problem in getting all of this stuff out. Okay, clerk will call the roll on the motion to pass out.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. What did we get? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. House Bill 2061 is passed to the floor. Let's go back to Senate Bill 310 while we're on landlord-tenant measures.
Ready to comment on 504 when you want me to.
Already? Just pass through. Okay, this is the landlord-tenant bill that we've been had a number of hearings on. Is there any
move it out
for the motion? Okay, the motion is to pass Senate Bill 310 to the floor to pass recommendation. Let's see, did we have a... We had amendments and had it in gross. Let's see, it was A in gross, Senate Bill. Did we amend... Honey, we amended apparently the A in gross version also. Is that correct?
310.
Yes. And we adopted those amendments? Yes, barely.
I would vote for that.
Yeah, we counted yours.
Yeah.
Who proposed these?
Those are the ones you asked.
These were the ones we, oh, these were the ones we adopted.
Yeah, right. Okay.
A and Gross Senate Bill 310, we did adopt further amendments to it, and they were, have been voted on. And I, it's as you should see, I think Connie brought it up today. Did we put the effective date in it? Do you know, Jerry?
I did. I'm just checking that. Seems, yes, we did, Madam Chairman. Reads, let's see. That would have been subsection 5, and it reads, the provisions of this act shall take effect only as to leases and rental agreements entered into after January 1st, 1976.
Okay, it appears that the bill is in order, that we did adopt all of the amendments, and so is there any further discussion on Senate Bill 310?
Oh boy, I'm good. I didn't hear on this thing.
When did we hear it? Four, oh, we had three hearings on it. Clerk, call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Jernstedt?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Oh,
motion fails.
Only.
Okay, let's go to. Are you?
I'm moving to table the bill.
Motion is to table Senate Bill 310. Clerk will call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No. Motion fails. Okay, 2379.
Better keep those other guys on this.
No.
What's going on?
2379.
Yeah, 2386, that should be pretty close. How many members are there on that board?
Well, there's different boards.
There's very different counties. County.
There's a different board for each county, housing board.
But is there any number, is it specific number that's on them?
I don't know. Who, Richard, pardon?
It could be between 5 and 9.
And they vary.
No less than 5, no more than 9.
We've had two hearings on this, and we held one hearing specifically for the opposition, and no one showed. And apparently there was no opposition in the House. Is that correct, Richard?
Well, we have an elderly person on there and a tenant on there, and this is a 5-member board.
I don't play games.
A 9-member board, that makes one member absent.
Yeah, I can get somebody's attention for a day or two. Maybe just 2 days.
So. Well, is there any...
I move to defer until next meeting.
I move it out.
My motion preceded yours, so I move to defer until next meeting.
The motion is to place House Bill 2379 on the agenda for Monday afternoon.
What's the purpose?
Oh, I'll chat with some people about that.
Oh, well, that's all. Just say so then.
Clerk will call a roll on the motion to place this bill on the agenda for Monday afternoon.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
What are you doing?
I'm just moving to defer until next meeting.
Place it on the agenda
meeting.
On Monday.
All right.
Senator Jernstedt?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Come on,
help me out.
You don't know.
No. What are we, 3 and 3?
Yeah.
Motion fails.
Move it out, do pass.
Okay, motion is to pass out House Bill 2379 to the floor of the do pass recommendation.
Well, I might have to oppose it on the floor.
I'll put a record mark.
Discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Jeez.
Aye.
Senator Grant?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails for lack of our fifth vote that's needed to pass it. Senator Howard changed his vote to aye.
For one meeting?
Yes.
Just for one meeting? All right, I change it. You just got somebody you wanted.
How do you vote, Senator Howard?
Voted no.
I'll vote for myself. I voted as supportive, so.
All right.
You supported Burbage?
The motion to pass the bill out fails. It will be on the agenda Monday afternoon. You won your motion.
All right. Now, you'll be running everybody here. You're good.
House Bill 2082.
Norm?
Strange things happen this time of session.
I already hunted up Don Barney.
It did, huh?
We'll get a telephone call right away.
Okay. Okay, this is our ingredient labeling thing. Do we have some amendments? Who told me about some amendments?
We haven't moved. You haven't voted on it.
It came from the amendments came from the other side.
I can't remember where my people want to take out flyers and fats.
From who?
Okay. What is this aimed at now?
Oh, this is that ingredient labeling thing.
Okay, this is Mr. Paul's amendment. They're interested in deleting the portion of the bill that refers to the identification of flour, fats, and oils.
And what would the bill do if we deleted that?
Well, it would require all other ingredients labeling except those that are accepted, which includes spices and flavorings and colorings would be exempt. And then the flours and fats and the oil would be exempt.
So the bill doesn't do it.
So we'd identify eggs, I guess.
Madam Chairman, just a comment. I'm afraid this is a consumer bill that would just add to the cost for the consumer. I won't say anything more.
Jerry sent an amendment down, but it's very complex. It's not dealing with this oils and fats.
Madam Chairman, what she wants is if food is pre-fried, then you don't have to specify the mixture of oil used. That's what she's trying to get at with that amendment.
But she doesn't get at it very well.
So, Madam Chairman?
Yes.
On that concept, though, that was one of the primary concerns that I had, both from the one witness that we heard testify, Oregon Idaho potatoes and the others, and the pre-fried foods. That's mainly the, and I'll be candid here for the record, my brother is a purchasing agent for Bluebell Potato Chip Company, and they deal mainly in oils and potatoes. And that was the concern that they had with the oil part. And if the amendment would reach to take care of pre-fried foods like that, that would pretty well take care of almost any of the people that have an oil problem as far as the purchasing. That's the major, my understanding, the major users in the foods of oil, so the ones who use it for frying.
Well, that's the sense of her amendment when pardon me for saying so, but when it gets all boiled down.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, she says, except if the food has been pre-fried in a blend of oils, the blend need not be identified as the source.
Sure, because they don't know what the cost of oil is going to be from one day to the next and the different kinds of oils they have in their pipeline of...
water products that way, though, Keith.
Well, that is, let them out.
Well, what's the pleasure of the committee?
Is beer classed as a food?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. I would think so.
You bet it is.
You don't drink beer, you don't care. I don't drink beer with it. I put all the ingredients on the whole there.
That makes them sick no matter what.
Just the alcohol content you care about.
Okay, why don't we get this amendment put in a little bit better shape and have it distributed to the committee to look at, and we'll take up House Bill 28 to another time. Now, hold on a minute. Betty Brown asked us to consider her two bills, 530 and 533, which she has amendments for, though she is excused from the meeting this afternoon. I want to talk to you about that because it's too complex. Do you have amendments on 530?
Yes, I do.
533. I put this on for two work sessions, and Betty could not be present both times, so she asked me today if we would go ahead and consider our amendment and let the committee work its will.
In both cases, Madam Chairman, the amendment is very simple. Rather than state the date in which it is to come off the shelf, it states the date in which it is to be processed.
5:30 we're on.
Why important work?
Jerry, you want to explain the Senate Bill 530 amendment?
All right. The amendment, the original bill states that we have to put the date on which the food must come off the shelf. And the objections from the industry were that the date wasn't the important thing, it was the temperature at which food was kept, etc. So, as a compromise, Senator Brown decided rather than put the date in which it must come off, we would put the date in which it was processed, and the consumer can judge whether or not it's too old or not. And that's basically what this amendment does.
It's just 5:30.
This is 5:30, that's correct.
Any interest in the amendments to the bill?
No, I'm not a question.
Okay.
Maybe Otto can answer it. When they process the canned goods, and then they store them in a warehouse out there without the labels, and then they, during the canning season, they got a warehouse full of unlabeled beans out there. Then they get ready for filling up some boxcars and shipping them off someplace. They'd have to have pre-dated labels that say what date that pack was, wouldn't they?
The cans, Senator Burbidge, would have to code on the lid.
But the customer couldn't read that.
That would tell them what the pack was. And then the label would have to be made with that date printed on it.
Wow, I can see where that's still going to cause a hell of a problem.
It's going to be worse than that.
Very confusing.
It'd be terribly confusing because you've got a warehouse full of canned goods sitting there that you don't know whether it's going to be Van Camp's or Libby's or you name them, Fred Meyer, Safeway, or anything else.
That part isn't what concerns me. They got start running those through there.
Well, that's what I mean.
Through that code and then put a date that it was packed. Hell, there's a different day that some of those beans are packed for
the little
30, 40, 50 days or whatever it is that they run beans or whatever they run the others.
Madam
It'll
Chairman.
Make the labeling more expensive, Madam Chairman. No question about that.
Okay, Jerry.
What Senator Brown was getting at was her contention was that they are indeed labeling the can by the stamp they put on the lid anyway in code, that they could change that code to put the date on the can. So it would have nothing to do with the label whatsoever. The can would be marked, it would be imprinted in the can, which they do for code anyway. And that was what she was getting at.
To do it on the can itself?
On the can, just so the thing had to be labeled. It didn't have to be on the label, the paper label. It could be done on the can.
Okay, you had the amendments before you come up.
The data on there was really, did us it, by all knew that.
They were not, they was little things they, I worked in the cannery.
Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 533, the amendments, Jerry.
Basically the same amendment again, Madam Chairman, except this one deals with frozen goods. They'd have to put the date in which it was processed rather than the date in which it must be taken off the shelf.
Okay. I did what I told her I'd do.
I'll tell you what we can do for her. We can move the amendments.
You are a big help.
That's what we did to your bill when you were gone.
I don't doubt that a damn bit. No, that's what he wants us to amend your bill.
We did, and then we saved.
We saved your bill.
Which one?
920. We're a bunch of buzzards.
I moved the amendments to Senate Bill 530 and 533, all at the same way. You'll take and put them in for her. And
you're back to work.
All right. The motion is to amend 530 and 533 together.
With these print amendments dated May 14th.
Are there any objections to the amending 530? Any objections to amending Senate Bill 533? Okay, Bob 504.
What did you do tonight?
Madam Chairman, I just discussed the definition of commodity investment contract with Legislative Council. It informs me that my concern is exactly correct, that the new definition would technically involve every transaction that is not on a board of trade or exchange, with every foreign commodity that I know of that is traded on a future delivery.
Or mill.
However, yeah. I think there is an overriding concern with respect to the Corporation Commissioner's opportunity to control fraudulent dealings, specifically in the gold and silver field. And I have a statement that I'd like to read, Madam Chairman, as legislative intent, which will allow me to vote for the bill. It says, it is not the intention of this committee that the Corporation Commissioner be given latitude to interrupt the ordinary course of commerce in commodities, except for cases involving willful fraud or deception.
Seems to me that could be written into the bill someplace, Senator Smith, but...
nobody's after you. You put it in there in the first section, yes. Just like I've got in that cancer research bill of setting.
Well, this is, I just wrote it down, and it's not in, it's informed enough for me to understand.
We could have done the best one, maybe we put it in where appropriate. I could get with Legislative Council.
Okay, let's do this. Let's take your statement and see if it can actually be worked into the bill,
right,
instead of legislative intent, and let Jerry work with Legislative Council and Mr. Healy.
Okay.
And actually put it in, notwithstanding and all this other
here
stuff.
Here it is.
You
want.
Okay.
Formed and stone.
Okay, so we're still holding 504. Now, what's going on with 312, Norm?
Now, 312 is the accountant's bill. The bill is in front of you as amended, and everybody agrees on... I see, she has it here. with the amendments in, and the bill is ready to, and it's all amended, it's ready to go.
Didn't we adopt the amendments the other
yes,
day and ask for the bill
amendments
to be engrossed?
Uh-huh.
No.
You've
just made up the amendments.
That's
yes.
Right.
Has the bill not been returned yet, Ty?
Well, I didn't even have amendments until just today.
Oh.
No, she had been out to rework the amendments.
Oh, okay.
And because we're getting so short, I would like to send it to the floor.
It's
a Senate bill, if we could. If not, we'll wait, and then I'll make the motion to send it forward.
And I have a question.
Okay, Senator Burgess.
I've got it written across the face of my initial 312 that it had somewhere. Somebody gave some testimony at a $15,000 impact that wasn't in the governor's budget to administer.
made. Does it still have?
It says north.
Somebody testified to that, or I wouldn't have jotted it down.
What was the testimony?
There was a $15,000 fiscal impact that wasn't in the governor's budget to administer the act.
The only thing I can think of is that might have had any reference to the Senate Bill 41. That's now in. Wait, you mean funding? But this is.
Is this the one that requires if you want us to go back to school?
This one outlines the type of.
The Senate Bill 41 that we sent down was a continuing education bill. This is the certification bill.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes,
all right, yeah. So this is what is necessary in order to become certified board of the county.
Would you rather wait till the bill comes back, Madam Chairman?
Make your motion. Let's see.
All right, I would move that we send Senate Bill 312 to the floor. The Senate do pass his amendment.
All right, which will be A, engrossed when it comes back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Discussion on the motion.
You're satisfied that everybody else is satisfied?
Yeah.
Well, he talks with accountants all the time.
The accountants, public accountants, and everybody's all agreed on it now.
Okay, the clerk will call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jensen?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Now, Madam Chairman, we did all this work on Senate Bill 41, the Senate the Ways and Means. It's in Subcommittee 2. They've ordered Subcommittee 2 closed down as of Wednesday morning. This is the whole bill on education, future education, and everything of this Senate Bill number 1. Now they say that if we go down and to me get down on my hands and knees to somebody, we might get them to stay another day and consider this bill. But we have Senate Bill 114 here in committee. It's on the table. It's an accountancy bill. I have amendments that will just delete all, and the only fiscal implication was one clerk and one typewriter in that bill that we sent to Ways and Means. I have the exact wording here with that one clerk and typewriter taken out, and this would just be the continuing, correct me now if I'm wrong, the continuing education program. And just exactly what the public accountants and the certified public accountants agreed to. And what it would take would be to take Senate Bill 112 off the table, delete it out, and put this in, and there is no fiscal implication, and send it to the floor of the Senate. There's been days going to this, and I hate to see it go down.
Ways and Means?
They're going to shut down Subcommittee 2.
Well, don't you have any influence down there?
Well, they won't hear this.
Don't you have any influence down there?
I have influence down there. I hope that I would like to take this escape route. If you'll take 114 off the table and amend this in, if I can't get that out of Ways and Means, I'd like to send this out. I've been working on this for 14 years, and I would like to.
Let's do it for him. Are you getting tired?
I'm not dead.
What was 114? I don't even know.
No, better than I did 14 years.
I know where
you're going. I think so, but
I
feel that way. Yeah, I do feel that better.
Is it an accountant bill also?
Yes, ma'am. Certified public accountants. It was by Senator Meeker.
That's right, what?
114 to have it, the exact wording of 41, except for the appropriation.
I'll meet with Jack Ripper personally and try to get this taken care of down there, but if it doesn't, Madam Chairman, I'd like to use this route.
And 114 does not have subsequent referral.
I move we take 114 off the table.
Motion is to remove 114 from the table. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jurcic?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. But you'll talk with Ripper first.
I'll talk with Ripper first. I would like to amend 114 now. To do it, just leave
it. I'm just telling we took the bill off the table and that we're waiting to see what they're going to do.
All right, all right.
Meeting's adjourned.
This is the Senate Consumer and Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 319 at 3 o'clock p.m. on May 19th, 1975.
Meeting comes to order, and to accommodate Representative Wolfer, we will take testimony on House Bill 2951. Representative Wolfer.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Representative Kurt Wolfer, House District Number 28. House Bill 2950 is a very simple bill. It just simply deletes the jewelry auctioneer statute. The reason for that is that we had a bill in front of our committee and the House side that transfers the authority from the Secretary of State to the Auctioneers Board, and because the Secretary of State didn't want it anymore, and in the testimony it came out that number one, no one had ever filed or used the statute, and secondly, that auctioneers are now bonded, and for each auction they must bond, and they're under a good degree of consumer protection already. It seemed to be kind of a superfluous statute. This bill, 2950, passed out of committee unanimously, and it passed in the House of Representatives unanimously. It's now before your committee. It's not really too much more that I can say about it, except that it just deletes it because as our committee looked at it, we felt there was no real apparent need for it.
And you can go back to all your constituents and tell them you're repealing as many laws as you possibly can, huh?
Well, yes, that's true too, I suppose.
They keep saying we need fewer laws. This is the way to do it.
Yeah, I think it's about 2.25 pages of the ORS is what it amounts to when you go through everything. So be open to questions if there are any.
Okay, Senator Smith and Senator Howard, we're on House Bill 2950 so that we could hear Mr. Wolfer's, Representative Wolfer's testimony while he's here. Senator Powell.
Jewelry auctioneers, what is the statute? They create jewelry auctioneers, or do they regulate?
It defines, the present statutes defines what jewelry auctioneers are, and essentially that's anyone who sells jewelry by auction, and then requires that they post a $1,000 bond, requires that they put their price list for the Secretary of State, what each item is, and then identifying each item 3 months prior to the auction, and then they can't change any of the items by description or price, or if there is a price minimum designation.
Basically, in the presenting and the selling of stolen merchandise.
I'm not sure what the original intent was.
Then the result of this might be that at public auction there might be more chance for jewelry to be sold.
That might have been true originally. As I understand it, the auctioneer statute passed after this legislation. Presently, auctioneers are required to post bonds and for themselves as being honest and good individuals, and then they can draw against the bond, and they have to have an auctioneer's license. So if they were to sell stolen jewelry, then they would lose their license and could no longer do any kind of auctioneering.
Put Senator Howard.
Who is Lynn Walton?
Oh, he is a person who is an old-time auctioneer. Or auctioer.
Does he own that auction house over there on 82nd Street?
Yes, that's correct. And Jeannie Rathbone is his daughter. And she's also an auctioneer. Yeah.
Is they auction yours, okay?
I couldn't tell you what their individual practice is.
Well, they do just about everything that suits the mess up the way.
I can answer that, too. They sell mostly on people that sell, but occasionally there is some jewelry on that particular statue for three benefits from selling it.
I see.
Repeat that,
They sell in that line of what would be jewelry is mainly antiques. However, they are prevented from selling jewelry at the auction.
Well, now, would this bill prevent jewelry from being sold at an auction?
They are presently, they are presently prevented now from selling jewelry without going through the statute.
Okay, so under the other auctioneer regulated provisions, they would be allowed to sell jewelry at auctions, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So in other words, we're removing the prohibition.
The special procedure, yes.
Yeah. Okay, other questions?
How poor people do about
it. Right on. I set mine on by them.
All right. Well, wait a minute. Senator Howard, you still worried? You need...
I have major... there's a big jewelry store going out of here just to... Somebody went to that store and wanted to sell all the tools, all that at auction. And you have to go to an antique dealer. How does he go about it if we don't have any?
No, under present law, he would have to post a $1,000 bond with the Secretary of State and then list each item with the Secretary of State before the auction. He would also have to be an auctioneer. All this statute does, it does not eliminate auctioneers. It eliminates the specific statute dealing with only jewelry auctions. And it just deletes the special designation for them and makes them as if they were any other item in an auction. And so then if this law were to pass and they wanted to auction those off, then they would hire an auctioneer and then he could auction them off.
Well, what I'm wondering, now the jewelry thief goes to the pawnbroker in Portland, in Palmer. He don't go there because the police have a closed check at the pawnbroker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's going to keep the jewelry thief from going to the auction house all over the state and saying, here, you auction this off for me. This is what I have. We have strict, I don't see anything wrong with a bond when you're going to sell a valuable equipment. That's what I
mean. Presently, if this law were to pass, there still be required to post a bond for the auction, and the auctioneer is bonded, and he is licensed within the state of Oregon. If he were to sell stolen goods, then he would lose his license, no longer be able to auctioneer. All this does is has to do with a special designation for jewelry set aside as a special kind of auction. And it, as I understand it, was passed prior to the time auctioneers were licensed. And so at that time it...
Do you agree?
On the bill to delete the jewelry auction requirement?
Yes.
From our point of view, there's two bills in. One is 2433, which we're trying to remove it from Secretary of State to the Board of Auctioneers. The Board of Auctioneers is trying to repeal the whole statute, but in our review of that provision of the law, we found that no one could qualify for the responsibility. No one could qualify to meet the requirements of that law. And it's somewhat unconstitutional.
So you're okay on the repeal?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
All the thing we want is just get rid of out of office, period.
Okay, I'd like, since we didn't get you to testify, the record should show that Secretary of State's office representative appeared and indicated that the Secretary of State is in favor of House Bill 2950. Right?
Calvin Henry by name.
Thank you, Mr.
And there's one auctioneer here, and
I don't know if he wants.
Okay, the chair would take a motion on this bill since we're getting late in the session. If anyone cares to
move it out to pass.
Motion is to pass House Bill 2950 to the floor. The due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burgess?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Dremsted?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Committee members will go to the work session of these bills, and I hope we can keep you all here together so that we can get them done in a hurry. Senate Bill 504, Mr. Healy, you want to tell us once more now what we're going to do with 504?
Senator Roberts, Brian Healy, Corporation Commissioner. We've had several discussions on Senate Bill 504, and I think that we have worked out all the problems on it. The bill did contain matters relating to commodity investment contracts. We have brought over and submitted to you an amendment deleting that provision. The problems of the religious institutions have been resolved. They've indicated their agreement with the bill, so we know of no opposition or no problems to this bill. Stands with the amendment deleting the commodity investment contract provision.
Madam Chairman, I move the adoption of amendments.
Senator Smith moves the adoption of amendments to Senate Bill 504. That's both sets of amendments, including the one that in which we have to amend the measure summary.
Yes.
Discussion on the motion. Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Dremsted?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
I move the bill on due pass as amended.
Senator Smith moves House Senate Bill 504 for the due pass. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Dremsted?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Healy.
Thank you.
Maybe we can get this thing going now. Let's see, with those amendments, we've got an A engrossed Senate Bill 504. Let's engross it to a B engrossed so it goes over the House cleaned up without any problems. And Senate Bill 856. Okay, this is the fisherman's bill, and we had Senator Ripper check with the representative, Mr. McMillan, I think was his name. Isn't that right? Hollis McMillan?
Mace.
Hollis Mace. And the proposals presented to us by Mr. Howitt are acceptable to the fishermen's organization, and they are eager for the bill.
Movement, the half set amendment didn't pass.
No.
I moved the amendments.
We had the amendments before us at the last meeting, but we didn't know how the fishermen felt about them.
Right.
So,
somebody catch up with us?
Yeah.
Do it down there?
Yeah.
What are the amendments?
Do you have a copy?
I have another copy.
Have we been adopted?
No. We just,
I just moved them.
It makes the fishermen responsible in setting up their own insurance provisions with the insurance commissioner. Do you have any other copies? Anybody want to see another copy of the amendments?
Howard is there if anyone has any questions.
If anyone has any questions, Mr. Howard is present. Okay, Senator Dremsted moves the adoption of the amendments to Senate Bill 856. Discussion? Are there any objections to the adoption of the amendment? They're adopted.
Move it out.
Senator Dremsted moves Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Dremsted?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye, and this should be engrossed too, Connie, because these amendments are rather extensive. And Senator Ripper will have to carry the bill.
Okay.
House Bill 2379. Chair, make a motion, Senator Burbidge?
What's the bill? 2379. It's putting a tenant on the
Burbridge moves House Bill 2379 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Grimstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. House Bill 2082, is that an amendment, Jerry, on that one?
No, it's not back, Madam Chair.
It's not back.
It was supposed to be back today, but it wasn't.
Okay, we hold that one. House Bill 2391. No amendments, Jerry, no amendments. No, nope, can't hardly be.
Very short bill.
Chair will accept the motion. Senator Howard moves House Bill 2391 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Allow savings and loans to have checking.
This one doesn't allow checking.
Mutual savings bank.
Mutual
savings bank. Our only one and only Oregon mutual savings bank.
They're actually the same thing.
I move the adoption of the amendments that were offered by the independent banks to this bill.
I don't think they offered any. Mr. Van Cleek testified, but he didn't offer any amendments.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Mr. Van Cleek, didn't you have an amendment to this bill?
Yes, I did.
Did you offer it when you testified? Gee, I'm sorry. I really approved on that one. Were they attached to the testimony by any chance?
Yes, they were.
Move the adoption of amendments to House Bill 2391, presented by Mr. Van Cleek. Discussion?
Somebody explain them.
Would you explain them, Mr. Van Cleek? Perhaps you could take the
chair. They're bringing in the seven
We'll let him tell us, Senator Howard.
This brings the interest rates on a comparable basis. If mutual savings banks were to elect to receive demand deposits, then their interest rates on time deposits would not exceed the maximum as allowed by commercial banks. And attached to that testimony that was given previously was a comparison of maximum interest allowable on time and savings accounts.
If they do that, will you agree to allow them to have commercial loans and all the other things that the independent banks have that they don't have?
If they were in a situation where they could comply with all the parts that a commercial bank does, yes. That would in effect ask them to convert to a commercial charter.
Well,
what you're asking would be the same effective thing as to ask them to convert to a commercial charter. What the original bill does is to take out a part of the law now which gives them the advantage of the interest rate difference as well as checking accounts. We're asking by amendment that if they should elect to take the demand deposit allowance, that they would then adjust their interest rates to that of commercial banks.
Okay, further discussion? Thank you, Mr. Van Creek, for your information. Clerk will call roll on the motion.
Senator Brown?
Is this on the amendment?
Yes.
No.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Drumstead?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. Was it counted?
Failed.
Sharp.
No.
Five no votes.
Okay, motion failed. Senator Howard moves House Bill 2391 to the floor of the Duke pass. Discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Drumstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion passes. Okay, on the hearings, we're going to go to the insurance commissioner, who says he can run through these bills fast. We do have to be back on the floor at 4 o'clock, and those of you who are here on the credit union bill, we're going to try to get to it. The insurance commissioner keeps his promise.
What is the phone number of the address included in this letter?
Everything else is just regulated.
I'm willing to do it.
Oh, you can do it on a motion.
Except that they're all going to get caught up in arguments. Everybody's seen that. So why don't you let us distribute that? Senator Burbidge wants a consideration of what's the bill number?
225.
225, but if he takes longer than
very quickly, as pointed out by the Department of Banking, there is absolutely no state regulation on revolving credit accounts. Over the signature of Mr. Olin, I'll read the one paragraph. As I mentioned to you over the telephone, there are presently is no law on the book that either regulates or restricts time sales charges on open-end accounts with merchants. And he goes on from there. Now, attached to this, you heard the great plea from them that they can't do business without considerable amount of interest, but when they're charging, as does this show right here, an annual percentage rate of 20%, and they can go up to 30 or 36% or whatever without any, it's time that the state of Oregon begin to regulate. And members would consider a motion to amend the bill to apply only to that, to 15%.
To revolving credit
accounts. To revolving accounts, and that's all, and get some kind of regulation on the state of Oregon.
I would order Sears and Ward.
Sears is charging 20.
Sears is charging 20%.
These bills come in, my God, they want to take in the whole thing and everybody.
Okay, that's all the bills.
An 8% insurance interest is.
Senator Burbidge, put your motion and let's make the.
Okay, I move that the Senate Bill 225 be amended to regulate revolving accounts at the rate of 15%.
And that the bill be amended and engrossed to do only that.
It does cover some other stuff that would take Claire out there. The only thing I've left in it is the other gas cap card. But
if the motion passes, the bill will be engrossed with that amendment in it and will come back to committee. Clerk, call roll on the amendment.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye. To bring it back.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Drinstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Okay, now,
that's
to bring it back. We didn't do anything except amend it. Get it back in committee. Okay, Mr. Rollins, let's go on. Which one do you want to start on?
2993. All right. Madam Chairman, for the record, I'm Lester Rawls, Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon. This particular bill merely adds to the present statute that inquiries from the commissioner will be in such form communication as requested by the commissioner. At the present time, it says that any person requested to reply to it shall do it in writing. Now, we haven't had a great deal of difficulty. Most often the people will cooperate, bring their file in, or talk to us on the phone, but we have had difficulties where they say the statute says in writing, therefore that's the only way you're going to get any response from us, is in writing. And there are times when we'd like to talk to them on the telephone, or we'd like to have them bring their file into the office personally, and so this merely just gives us that authority.
Is there any opposition, Madam Chairman?
Signed up? No.
The bill,
is there anyone in the room who's opposed to this bill or who wants to testify? Motion is to move House Bill 2993 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Have you thoroughly checked the wording so that there's no hang up with the. Seems like something right. Like this could. One word could mean a lot.
Well, it's our bill, Senator. We hope that it covers it generally enough that it says in the form of the communication requested by the commissioner. So when we either write to them and say to either come in personally or call them on the phone and tell them to come in, or we might even just say reply to us in writing, which is mostly what we do. We ask for a reply in writing, but there are times locally when you want the claims manager to bring the file in to take a look at it. They're just a minority company to do it, but they're enough to cause the difficulty.
Are you sure you wouldn't use it for harassment to make them run to Salem all the time and see you in person?
No.
Still?
I promise you won't demand sign language.
I promise you won't.
Clerk, will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Drumstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Okay, 2994?
2994, Madam Chairman, is a bill which we have to give you a little background on the bill. It's a little bit complicated. This arose because of a decision by the California Supreme Court, which in essence said that when a person, we have in the statute now that the company must give notice if they're not going to renew the policy on an automobile policy. As most of us have our insurance on automobile, it comes to us by direct billing from the company. Then you send back your billing to the company with your check and it renews the policy. It's on a continuous billing. Now what happened in California is an insured failed to send back his billing and his check. Several months later, after the policy had expired and he had not sent back his check, he was involved in an accident. He went to the court and said, this merely sets up a debtor-creditor relationship. They have to give me notice that they're not going to renew the policy or the policy is automatically renewed, even though I don't pay for it. And the court concurred in that type of argument, hard to believe, so that this bill merely says that if a person doesn't pay his premium, that the policy is terminated. He can't go on and on and on and wait and take his chances and then 6 months later or a year later have a loss and then come back and say, well, merely set up a debtor-creditor relationship. I'll pay you the premium now, but you have to pay the size of a loss that I've been
And, yes, California, by the way, after that court case came down, immediately went into passed a similar legislation. We've not had the case arise here, but this is something to prevent that type of thing from arising.
Questions? Senator Powell?
Is there anything in the insurance code or anything that requires a grace period of 30 days? Is there a specific grace period now?
Not in the code in automobile insurance. Many companies do say that your policy is going to terminate on the 1st of July. If you pay by July 15th, your policy will be reinstated. That's not required. What is required by the present code is that if they're not going to renew your policy, they must give you
20 days
notice prior to the time of renewal.
Does California have a statutory grace period?
No, not that I know of on automobile insurance. I don't know of any state that has a grace period in automobile insurance. Most of your companies, however, will give you from the date that you're supposed to pay, they'll say reinstate if you pay within 2 weeks or something.
Other questions?
What would happen in the case of a mail? Something happened in the mail and the check was destroyed or lost and the person actually...
We've had that case in a hearing, Senator, and we held in the hearing that there was sufficient evidence that people had mailed the check and the required the company to go on the loss. That would be a matter that evidence, the law presumes that something mailed is received and...
But this statute wouldn't prevent you from making such a ruling?
No. This just merely says that if the person doesn't pay, and in this case in California, the man admitted he didn't pay. But he said, that doesn't make any difference. You have to give me 20 days notice that you're not going to renew. Therefore, you automatically renewed my policy even though you weren't paid. So this merely says you don't pay.
And in effect, it says that the notice, the premium notice you send him, wipes out the requirement of sending him a non-renewal notice.
He's got notice that he has to pay his premium.
Other questions?
I have one where he made him pay.
Senator Cook.
Isn't it the practice with some of the insurance agents to handle the renewals of these policies themselves? In other words, certainly the agents handle it, and I would think there could be some confusion here without the actual notice of the cancellation or intent to cancel in the event the premium is not paid.
Well, if the Senator, I would say about 95% of the business on automobile, personal, private passenger automobile, which we're talking about here, is on a direct billing basis between the company and the insured. Now, on that limited amount where the agent, the old-time way, used to contact the insured, the company must still give notice to that insured 20 days in advance if they're not going to renew, or he can renew the policy. Now, if the agent doesn't contact the insured in time and he doesn't get notice, then the responsibility would be on that agent. And I would assume that we would say that if he hasn't any notice at all, no premium notice, no notice from his agent, that he's got a right to have that notice and the policy would be renewed. But this is saying when he does get the premium notice in the mail, and he doesn't return the premium, doesn't pay, he can't go on for 6 months to a year and just take his chances on having an accident and come back and say, well, I'm now ready to pay the premium, you cover the loss.
Yeah, but my concern is that I'm sure that I've had arrangements with insurance agents in the past where I handle the whole account. When it was a direct mail, it was understood, and when it wasn't a direct mail, it was there was a different understanding. My concern is making this automatic for all policies, unless it's made clear to the insurer that failure to pay this premium is going to result in cancellation. What would be wrong would require... Well, I'm sure that I've had this in my own case, and others must have the same thing, where they deal through a given insurance independent agent who writes insurance through a variety of companies, and while maybe it's most of them are billed direct, I don't know that they all do. I'd be concerned here with saying that if you, I was just trying to think now what my practice is with, on my current automobile policy, is whether or not it's something where it's a part of the general account that I have, or whether it's something where I mail the check directly back to the company.
Well, it should be brought out that if the agent tells you you're insured,
he's liable.
The company's liable.
Okay.
The company is absolutely liable if I tell your agent and you call me up and say, Norm, I can't get the check to you till next week, and I say, well, bring your cover.
Well,
you're covered.
Yeah, but this language would seem to be contrary to that. Doesn't it say that here that if you get the notice of premium and it isn't paid within that time, then you're out? I mean, what's wrong with the requirement, even if it's included in the notice of premium, that if the premium isn't paid by such and such, that the policy is being canceled? Now, that's not presently required.
Well, that's what it says in the policy. That notice of,
now, how about in the notice?
It does say in the notice. It must be paid by July 1st.
Or
the policy terminates.
Is that what all the notices say?
The majority of them say that. I don't know of any. Now, there were some that, for instance, in State Farm, we had State Farm and Farmers. We had a conflict about their notice was a little ambiguous, I felt, and we had to reword their notice. But they do say that, and this merely says that when they do receive that and they don't pay within that period of time, that in fact, does cancel the policy, and they don't go on to the debtor-creditor relationship.
Madam Chairman, I suggest this amendment so that it's clear that for the notice to have this effect, I mean, it's in substance, I'm moving this now, the billing must clearly state that failure to pay that premium within whatever number of days it is shall result in the cancellation of the policy. Now, that way, nobody's going to get trapped, but there may be other people around that are in a situation similar to mine.
Yeah, of course, really, Senator, the bill already says that.
Well, what does the notice say then?
Well, the notice is one of expiration. The bill doesn't refer to a premium billing, actually, although this is what is understood. The premium billing is, under the terms of this bill, a notice of expiration. A notice of expiration has to be sent if this non-renewal requirement does not pertain. And a notice of expiration is just that. It's a notice that the policy is going to expire.
Well, all I'm asking is to make doggone sure, and my amendment would say that notice of expiration must contain specific language addressed to the policyholder that if the premium is not paid by the date of expiration, that the policy is canceled.
Madam Chairman,
Senator Vern,
in your case, the agent is liable for whatever contractual arrangement he has with the company.
I don't know every one of them. I'm sure you're insured.
Just a minute, Senator Howard.
This says if you don't pay, Vern, I'm going to cancel you.
Well, if that's the effect, don't you think that's what you ought to tell him?
This is the effect. I don't want to. It's still public relations for me to write a bill to every company and say, every one of my customers and say, hey, if you don't pay, it's just like if you said a deal out of your business and say, if you don't pay by a certain time, I'm going to sue you. There won't be any business back.
Senator Jernstead.
Well, I was just going to point out, I don't think Senator Cook's point is relative to this bill. As I see it, because the agent is responsible to the insurance company, and it's an arrangement between the customer and the agent. If the agent wants to stick his neck out and say, yes, you're insured and carry the account, well, that's the agent's business.
I have all kinds of accounts that I carry people's accounts, but I don't want to tell them if you don't pay me, I'm going to cancel you.
What? Yes, the expiration means termination. I understand that, but my question is, how is it going to work? Are they going to send out a billing, right?
Yes,
send out
a notice of a billing, which states in there that your policy will expire on June the 1st, 1975.
Your renewal premium is X number of dollars.
And that's covered in line 31 where it refers to a notice of expiration. It doesn't say a billing. It's called a notice of expiration.
And where is it?
In line 31 on page 3.
Then page 4 says failure to do any of the terminates anywhere.
Well, that's on in the event of a replacement policy having been issued. If you go out and obtain other insurance, then... Well, line 2, a policy shall terminate on the effective date of any replacement.
Oh, okay.
Well, my point still is, so it is a notice of expiration. They send a notice saying your policy is going to expire. Now, many people on various policies have had policies that have expired, and yet the agent who wrote the business renewed it.
Well, in that case, then that policy that expires, that contract which expires, is expired, but that agent is responsible as an agent of that company for the contract that he may have bound that insured on with another company. We've got one contract under one situation and another contract under another situation.
Well, what I'm suggesting here is that when they send out this notice of expiration, that it should contain thereon that unless the premium is paid, what is it usually, by the expiration date?
Well, they say that the policy will expire on such and such a date, July 1st, and premium must be paid by this date to continue your policy. Otherwise, the policy is terminated.
All right, now is that said in every notice?
Every notice that goes out. That we've reviewed the one that the farmers, I believe, and there was some ambiguity in it, and we made them change it.
Well, if it doesn't, line 17 and 18 on page 3 demanded it does.
Yeah, replacement.
Okay, is there further discussion on 2994? Mary Howard moves House Bill 2994 to the floor to pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burby? Senator Cook?
I abstain.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jensen?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
I find that one nice.
They wouldn't let you.
Bad.
Okay, 2995?
Madam Chairman, 2995. Merely increases the basic financial responsibility limits of liability required in an insurance policy from the present $10,000, $20,000 to $15,000 per individual, $30,000 per occurrence. The 1020 was set many years ago and it really is not sufficient as inflation takes over and carries on, so we're just increasing that. We had originally suggested 2550, but the House committee felt that and passed the House at 1530. Now, Madam Chairman, on page 4, line 14, and line 17, and line 19. The bill passed the House at amending the $50,000 to $30,000. However, we would suggest this amendment should have read $35,000 because you have to have for financial responsibility when you have a single limit, which this will be the total, and that'll have to include $5,000 for property damage. So that should have read $35,000 rather than $30,000.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Now, this is mandatory insurance that every individual must have. Correct?
No. Only if they have to have insurance policy. If the policy is issued, then they are, for one reason or another, then this is what it has to be, but they don't have to have it.
If they're required to show financial responsibility, then they must have a policy with the minimum limits. It would be $15,000, $30,000. Senator, the Oregon law will allow you to drive without insurance. However, if you were involved in an accident, you must then show financial responsibility and pay for that accident if you're liable, or if you're...
I should have liability insurance.
But the law ought to be, but that's not part of it.
I don't pay any first accident.
You don't pay any first accident?
Okay.
You have one bike.
Free ride.
Well, you have to pay for that loss in case you're liable before you.
What's then the difference in premium cost between $10,000 and $15,000 and $20,000 and $30,000?
Well,
it's both. Between $10,000 and $15,000 and $20,000 and $30,000.
I think Mr. Bessonet probably has got those figures right handy with his file. He does. If I could defer that question to him.
What are they, Tom,
do you have the answer?
I'm Tom Bessonet, the casualty claims manager, and I don't have them on the break at 20 and 40, but I do have them at 25, 50. And the current premium would be $41 for 10 and 20, and that's for 6 months. For 25, 50 would be $47 for 6 months, and for 15 and 30, which the bill required, would be $45. This is for a standard driver in the metropolitan area of Portland. Rates will vary from geographical locations.
41 to 45.
Yes.
Basically.
To go to 15 and 30.
Be $6 a year for the...
$6 for 6 months.
$4 for 6 months in Oregon Mutual would be $8 a year. About 10%, I think you could just about figure out the average premium. They're doubling, or they're getting, 50% more protection from 10 to
50. Okay, Senator Howard.
I think, and I want to say that I have a real conflict of interest on this, and this does nothing to make me money. They're talking about what we should know. They're talking about the standard rate. Now, a person that has a bad driving record, this is going to cost him a lot more. A young driver, 16, 17, 18, those rates are high, and in proportion, it will be up. Over the years, I've been in the insurance business for a long time. We just kept increasing these a little bit at a time so that the person that's injured out there is taken care of. I will announce them before. I'm going to look for it, but I do have a conflict.
I'm Chairman.
Senator Smith.
I have not heard the defense of the need of this bill other than inflation. Are there other arguments?
Well, the argument is, I think, Senator, just that there are many cases in which, first we've run into the uninsured motorist, which we have one bill that's coming up, that the 10,000 limit on that is, by the high cost of medical coverage and so forth, exhausted quite often, and that goes parallel with this. And secondly, quite frequently, people will just carry the minimum, and it isn't sufficient to take care of the injuries of the injured party. Automobile liability coverage, you mentioned it being compulsory, and for all intents and purposes, it is really. In this state, we've got one of the highest insured populations in the United States, even though ours is not, quote, compulsory. And the philosophy now, as opposed to years ago when this first came in, was to protect the assets of the driver, and no one really looks at that, or very few anyway, any longer. They really look at what this particular liability will do when it takes care of the injured person who the party may injure in driving his automobile. So no fault and all these type of coverages really extend over. The philosophy is now, is this sufficient coverage to take care of the person they injure? And the 10,000 limit just isn't sufficient anymore.
Are you assuming that that's because the average personal injury case has having to do with motor vehicles is higher than $10,000?
I wouldn't really say the personal injury. I'd say it's more involving the medical bills, the medical care for seriously injured people. It doesn't take too much to go up to that figure. I mean, you take a look at the disability and the medical bills.
Well, I don't want to argue with you, Commissioner, but you don't have any statistics to give me. And that sounds excellent. You're probably right.
Wait until tonight, Senator Smith, if you need statistics on. You'll get them from the doctors tonight about their habits.
Thank you very much. I didn't plan on being
there
tonight.
Senator Burbidge?
You gave what the average, or what the standard would be. Somebody answer what it would cost for a 23-year-old person? Where does the age of rate for the higher risk? How much would it cost to increase in premium?
Well, as Senator Howard pointed out, it'd be considerably higher because they start with a higher base. The increase is about the same, 10% or so, but you're starting with a higher base in the beginning. So you're talking about, if it's $40, you may be talking about $65 or $80.
Maybe my question is, what age are you to get into that standard rate?
Well, it starts at 16, and goes anywhere from some companies cut it off at 23, some companies run it up to 28, depending upon
the high risk starts at 16.
Right.
Where's the standard rate?
Well, as I say, some start at 23 and married, others go to 25 and married, some go to 28 years old before they start going from 28 to 45 or 28 years on. Different. Each company almost has a different rating formula.
Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Cook, we're going to have to get down to the floor, so let's...
Your original proposal was 25 and 50. What was your argument in support of the bill in its original form?
Well, the same argument I've given here. I think the limits of liability to take care of the injured persons requires that there be a higher limits available.
25 and 50 is a more reasonable figure in view of current expenditures than 15 and 30.
My personal feeling would be that way, but I've been shown the error in my ways that we would be the highest state in the union if we went that way, Senator. And then when you talk about the commercial cost to truckers and things of that nature would be much higher, and Senator Howard, the cost to drivers, underage drivers, and drivers with bad records would force it really probably to be too high and too big a jump in one moment.
How long have our limits been 10 and 20?
I looked that up some time ago. It's been...
What year?
January of 1968.
January of 68. Now, does 15 correspond to the increasing cost of living or the rise of medical costs, or how much below it is it?
Tom Bessonette again. This part of my testimony should be good.
Yeah, he was signed up to testify.
I'm signed to testify in favor of this. Actually, that doesn't quite keep track of the inflationary trend since 1968.
What should it be if we wanted it to keep up with it? What would the rate be if we kept up with the inflationary trend?
It would be somewhere around $16,000 instead of $15,000.
Oh, well, so, split the difference to 20.
Well, may I share my testimony now?
Go ahead, Tom. You're identified on the tape.
Okay. Actually, I'd like to review just briefly. There are three states that now have 5 and 10 liability limits. There are 27 states that have 10 and 20, similar to Oregon. There are 14 states that have 15 and 30, and there are 6 states that have 20 and 40, and no states have any higher. 48% of the policyholders in Oregon Mutual now carry more than the basic limits in the state of Oregon, so we're only talking about 52% of potentially the policyholders in the state of Oregon as being increased in their premium. Since 1973, the last session, our average expense on per bodily injury case was about $1,300 per settlement per person. Today, it is $1,800, or it has increased one-third. Now, this is just the average. This is for the bump on the bruise or the person that's critically injured. We are finding time and time again that the $10,000 is not adequate to handle not even major injuries anymore. The moderate injuries, a broken leg and with substantial loss of income is just not adequate anymore. And therefore, we did ask that it be increased at least to 15 and 30 because we're trying to protect those people that are hard to insure the substandard driver. We've prayed that we will cause them to go out of the insurance business entirely and not buy any insurance. So we would rather keep it at a level that they can possibly afford, and therefore they will insure themselves so that the rest of the public will have some advantage of at least a 15 and 30.
Tom, what happens to people who now are covered under the 10 and 20? They'll continue until their policy expires?
It rolls on. It rolls on January of 1976.
Oh, okay.
That'll give us, most automobile policies are renewed every 6 months, and that'll give us the lead time to roll them on, or they will have at least the insurance, we'll have to comply with the law, so if they have 2 more months on the policy, we'll
so
have
everybody
to
that's taking the minimum now, the next notice they get, their insurance premium's going up.
It will probably announce that it will have to go up, but they say they don't want it yet. They would have, they could only, we could only force them to buy the 10 and 20.
Until January 1st, 17th.
Until the policy was renewed after January 1st sometime, because we would not bill them for the interim time of 2 months in 1976 because it cost too much to try and bill for $2.
Okay, other questions on this bill?
Do you know,
Senator Burbidge?
You gave a statistic that 50 some odd percent of the people buy now in excess of what this law demands.
Yeah. Betty, before you go, excuse me, Senator Burbidge.
Another 40%, what group do they fall in? The high-risk group, mainly?
Yep. Senator Burbidge, hold on just a minute. We have to go to the floor, but I want you to remind you that we're having the medical malpractice hearing tonight. It's going to take all of us to solve this problem. I hope that all of you can be present. Bob, you've indicated that perhaps you cannot, but I hope that the other...
Oh, I'll be here. 7 o'clock?
7 o'clock right here in this room tonight.
Okay.
Senator Burbidge.
Senator Burbidge, in answer to your question, a great portion of that population would be those individuals that were carrying high-risk insurance. What percent, I have no idea.
We'll pick up at this point on Wednesday.
I apologize.
Okay, we'll try to get through, we'll finish this bill, and then we'll go to the other two. Ted, you want your bill on Wednesday? Well, we can't do it today. All right. Jerry, let's start with 229.